from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Ryan Harkness.
Today on the show, we're going to have part two of our Book of Samuel, which is now, I think, actually going to be a three-parter, now that I think about it. So it's going to be a long one. It's like the Moses trilogy. It's a huge one, man.
Like, is it just in raw pages? Is it just like a you're going and, you know, at the top it has the list of the books and you just flip every couple of pages, it's a new book. But then Samuel is like the Stephen King of the Bible.
I guess just a lot more shit happens. Like, let me give you an example, right? When you're in Genesis and they talk about how Cain kills Abel, it's one sentence. Okay? That's brief. Not a lot of details there.
And it's, you know, it gets a lot more attention than that would imply.
Well, it's at the beginning of the book, so it gets a disproportionate amount of attention because anybody who's ever picked the Bible knows that they give up right around Moses. That's when they give up. You're just like, I'm tired. I tire of the story. I don't care anymore. It's a common trek. That's why everyone's so familiar with those stories.
Yeah, it's true. Everybody tries to read it, and most people fail. It's harder than a diet.
It's just, you know, for me, the fire that's under my motherfucking ass is to get the book done. So I'm glad. I'm doing like one of those kung fu things where they have that stick that's right near your anus. Make sure that you just sort of don't relax your muscles when you're doing the horse dance. That's where I am right now.
You know, these are just leading to horrible mental visions, I must say.
I hope so, because you know what? This whole show is going to be full of horrible mental visions of what's going to happen. This is the book of the story of Saul and David are unpleasant, okay? Which is why every once in a while, whenever you see a movie, a movie that's based on the Bible, I love watching these movies now. Because my familiarity with the story allows me to see which parts they just cut the fuck right out.
The Tom Bombadils of the Bible.
Well, you look at the way that they portray the stories in order to get to certain demographics, you know. Like, I love the way that they alter it. That tells you more about the people watching the movie than the filmmakers themselves. Because, I mean, who knows what the fuck choices really were made during crafting of any movie. Which is why I'm reading King David. I just finished King David. And I was looking forward to this because there's a Richard Gere movie called King David. Yeah, Richard Gere plays King David. And as you can imagine, it's fucking terrible.
Well, what year was this made?
1985.
Oh, nice. I'm applying like a weird kind of shitty 80s porn filter to everything now.
You know what, though? There's a couple things about the movie that I like. Number one, the battle scenes are bad but good. They're bad in a way that it's just really cheap, but they're cool in a sense that I'm like, that's kind of what a battle would probably look like, actually. You know, it's not glorified because I don't think they had the ability to glorify it.
Yeah, they just went ahead and said, you swing your thing until you stab this guy and then you go down.
Exactly. So you watch that and you're like, oh, that's realistic. Now 300 is like a fucking video game. Nobody's fighting like that. What the hell? And the thing that you love, too, when you're watching, there's one scene where the Jews are getting slaughtered, and this is near the end where Saul's going to get his ass kicked. But you look at their armor, which is nothing more than a bunch of cloth, and you're like, you suck. All your technology sucks. Everything really blows. No wonder the Lamoid Egyptians, the ones that were the D squad that are sent over to your neck of the woods, could still conquer your ass? Because he's backwards. Very backwards. Watching that movie, that's the first part I really liked. I also really loved the fact that they take all of the romance scene that's supposed to be in a typical movie, but now you're just like, hey, this is the Old Testament, so he's going to be banging multiple chicks. So how are you going to deal with that? How do you make that palpable for the lady audiences?
It just gets smoothed over back in the day.
They tried to exploit the brief possibility of a romance.
They pay some lip service. They're like, for the dames, we're going to put in, you know, someone spooning. I don't know why it's a 50s or 30s movie or whatever.
I don't know why.
They're going to swoon over Richard Gere.
Meh. Do you remember the movie Star Trek First Contact? Do you remember the Borg Queen?
Yes.
Okay. Now here's the thing. I never saw her during her prime, except for when I saw this movie.
I would have sex with her.
Oh, do you? Well, then maybe you should watch this movie because she plays Bathsheba. So there's this one scene where they're oiling up her tits, and it's 1985 tits.
And they're just showing them?
They're just showing them.
Ah.
And it's all oiled up and shit.
1985.
And she looks great. She looks like a sexier Audrey Tautou. That's what she looks like.
So what you're saying is that rather than listening to our podcast on the Book of Samuel, we should be watching the Richard Gere movie version?
I'll tell you what. I've been seriously considering doing one of those riff tracks where while you're watching the movie, I just tear it to shit by describing the inaccuracies. That'd be kind of fun, don't you think?
Yeah.
Because that's what I enjoyed. I enjoyed watching it saying, if I was a literalist, I would be offended by many of these changes. Because I'm a literalist. I want the fucking story as is. And the people who are sort of like, wow, that's really nice. King David, what a nice guy. Oh, yeah? I don't think you know the whole story, man. The review for that movie, by the way, it's the hardest thing for me to... I'm usually very good at researching movies. This movie has nothing except for one review that says, this movie is terrible. That's it. That's the only review you could find. No one even wanted to talk about it after it was done.
Imagine that a movie's footprint was so small that at this point in time on the internet, only one person has ever commented on it. That is like a pretty sad, like, ripple in a pond. It's like when that stone got dropped in there back in 1985, maybe people paid attention to it, you know. There was like a red carpet premiere or something, but now no one gives a fuck. It's not even in, it's probably not even on Netflix. That's how far you've fallen.
Maybe there's someone out there that loves the writer who also wrote, remember that Molesty movie In the Name of the Rose?
Yes.
The guy who wrote the screenplay wrote that later. So maybe there's a fan of his somewhere that devoted an impossible-to-find website detailing movies that critics have said, this is not a good movie.
Or recording entire podcasts talking about them.
Well, we'll give them their piece of history. You know what? They will. And maybe someone's going to write a wiki about it because we're the only ones who actually talk about it. Here's my hope. By the time people finish reading Bible stories, they will go and they will watch these other hacky movies to make fun of their dishonesty. They all have to be dishonest. They can never be honest anymore about what it is they believe because it's vile and disgusting. That's what's so great about my job. It's easy. It writes itself. So with that, we're going to have to do a recap because I'm sure that since we've had many episodes, people are probably don't remember. What the hell is Book Samuel all about again? Who's Samuel? What the hell? I have a busy life. Jacob, can you give me the 30-second or whatever long roundup? So let me give you the short version. So Samuel is a judge or prophet who basically is left by his what was once a barren mother. She gives her son away because he has so much free will, and he becomes a priest, and God loves to talk to him all the time and tells him that he's going to anoint a king. Despite the fact that God is very angry at the fact that he doesn't like kings. Kings are fucking terrible. But he's like, well, they want one anyways, so I'm going to give them one, and they're going to pay. And then later, there's a guy called Saul. He's from the tribe of Benjamin. He's the best-looking dude of the bunch. And when he shows up to Samuel, who's immediately impressed by how tall and handsome he is, decides this is the guy. And then he anoints him and says, you're going to become king later. And when they do the crowning ceremony, Saul, who's hiding under some luggage, gets dragged out, gets named king, but nobody really likes him, and they think that he's really lame. But then they have a whole fight and war, and God's on their side, so Saul wins, and then everybody's like, oh, well, Saul is kind of cool, so we love him. Except for when he starts being a bit cocky, he does not kill everyone that God wants him to kill. I'll be specific about that. He wanted all of the Amalekites, all of them, to be slaughtered. And instead, Saul chooses to make peace. And when we last left, this is where Samuel comes over and he's very displeased. And he's like, God has turned his back on you because you're not the genocidal monster we thought you were. And at this moment, Saul sort of like down on his knees and he's like, please, no. And that's where we left. So he's clutching at his robes and he's, and just as Samuel walks away, the robes get torn, and Samuel's like, what the fuck, dude? This is the state of the country now. You tore it apart because you wouldn't kill everybody. They bring out the Amalekite king, King Agag, and he's all smiles because he's like, well, they've already agreed to let me go. So maybe they've come back here and they want to make another concession or whatever. He's pretty much checked out. He's like, oh, fuck this shit, you know, I'm done. So he's all smiles, and this priest guy starts, I don't know, spewing his, the Lord will cut you down, and then he just fucking kills him and slices him up in all these fucking tiny pieces in front of everybody. Clearly he's pissed. They depart, and everyone leaves really uncomfortable. No one knows what's going to happen, but one thing's for sure, God has apparently turned his back on Saul. And the way that they make it sound in the Bible, being with God sounds like it's like the power of Grayskull or something like that. You know what I mean? It's like a warm feeling where everything you do, you feel like you're in the right. It's probably one of those creepy feelings that psycho killers have or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolute certainty in everything that you do because it's what your Lord commands. There's nothing dangerous about that at all.
No, it seems absolutely reasonable. What a frame of mind, right? It's like, well, no one can disprove what I believe, and I'm going to act on those beliefs. Oh, well, what a fantastic idea. So Samuel goes back home, and he's crying, bawling his eyes out, because I guess he regrets ever anointing this guy. Maybe he should have learned a lesson about the kinds of criteria you have. I don't know, that's just me. Finally, God's like, all right, it's time to get over this guy. It's time to fucking move on, and I'm going to announce who the new king is going to be. Samuel is not an idiot. Obviously, he realizes, I can't just go around declaring a new king because I'm going to fucking get killed. Here's what an infinitely powerful deity suggests that they do. He suggests that he just lie. He brings along a cow and something to sacrifice and walk into the town that he's basically going to be sent to, pretending that he's there for an offering while really he's there to anoint a new king. So, deception shall be your guide, sir. He finds Jesse, who is the ancestor of Ruth. Remember from the Book of Ruth, that boring-ass book that we had to go through?
Yep.
Yeah, the whole reason that she's there is just because she's important, because she's the great-grandmother of Jesse, who's now been told by Samuel, he's like, well, I'm here to perform a sacrifice. Lie. I want you to gather all your family here. And when they do, at first he sees the firstborn, Eliab, and he's like, wow, he's so good looking. He must be the one. To which God now sort of like communicates instantly to him, being like, what is wrong with you? This is not the criteria for picking a leader, okay?
Tell America. Don't believe his beautiful hair. It's a trap.
It's in the Bible, everyone. Don't vote based on looks. Even God says it'd be like, come on, Samuel. It didn't work out so good the first time when you picked the best-looking dude in town, did it? Huh? And by best-looking, like, here's the important thing, too. I don't know if I mentioned this, but tallness is important. The tallest will usually be the leader. Be like, who is the tallest? I feel like it's Invader Zim, but that's for real, man. The tallest was the leader. What an important criteria. So the first son, obviously he's rejected. All seven of these sons, in fact, he feels, I guess he's got seer stones or whatever these fucking crazy weirdos do to try to divine which is the right one. And finally realizes that it's none of these guys. He's like, do you have another kid? And they're like, well, yes, our youngest, but he's out with the sheep. He's you know, who cares about him? The youngest. Nobody's expecting anything out of him or anything. And they bring him out. So he's apparently at first, he's kind of a humble kid, which is nice. That's not going to last very long, though. So he's a humble kid. They bring him out. And despite the fact that he's quite short, quite small, with being an issue again, he's like, well, it must be him. He feels some kind of impression. God gives him that certainty that we're so frightened of. And he pours some oil on his head, you know, olive oil, which is a local trade. It's like whatever you got locally. Oh, we got some whale fat. I'm going to just put it on your head. Ta-da, God loves you. And the power of Grayskull overtakes David, and everything that he does from that moment on is just going to be awesome. He, like, levels up instantly or something. I don't know what it is.
Oh, it's like cheat codes. Cheat codes all over the place. He was anointed by the game genie.
Yeah, exactly. But he can't quite hack the game. I think it's just more like an item that gives you power.
Look, I mean,
charisma plus two or something.
When you think about the power that Neo really had, as soon as he began to master it, he wouldn't be able to rip everything apart. You just have to accept that for this narrative tale, they're going to, you know, the power is only going to be as good as the situation needs it to be. And then it's going to be used in a very stupid and, you know, it's kind of like, why does it...
Pointlessly violent.
Yeah, exactly. It's like once he does one magical thing where he just lifts up his arm and the armies lay down, at that point, he should just do that every single time. It should be a nice variety of... And then he did this to the tiger. It's like with Superman. It should always just be his laser eyes. He should just use that every time. And that's how it would be if it wasn't for them trying to mix it up, make it more exciting, you know?
Yeah, well, it's true. If Superman did the laser eyes to everything, he would just be over pretty fast.
He would just be Cyclops, and nobody likes Cyclops.
Yeah, that's why nobody likes Cyclops. Because he's too accurate, and he just should take out your brain. So you have to write him as a lame-ass shot. You're like, seriously, you can't hit anything? Well, no. No, or else everything dies. Like, that's the big problem. Let's get back to Saul. Saul is feeling blue, man, because he's lost God's love, and I guess he knows that his days as king are probably numbered now that he doesn't have God on his side or something like that, or at least the priest class, who seem to not be too pleased by him. But he's in a dilemma, right? Hey, Samuel's the one who anointed me, and now he doesn't like me anymore. That's got to be a pretty stressful situation. It's like, well, should I kill him? I probably should just wait until he dies or something. That's probably the best thing. Then once he dies, I'll just pretend that I know or speak for him, and then I'll do whatever the fuck I want. That's what I do. But I'm a Machiavellian. So because he's so blue, he goes over and he asks people to find him a harp player, which is kind of the equivalent today of a guitar player, because really that's the evolution of the guitar. And I mean, the harp's been around for a long time here. This is a Sumerian fucking instrument, so this is that's the normal thing that people just play. Hey, what's the instrument you got? Oh, you're playing the harp. Oh, you're that douchey dude at the party who just plays the little harp and he always getting laid. Still back then, man, that happened. Ancient Samaria, there were douchebags in campuses too. So they go out and they decide to find the finest harp player, who just happens to be God's golden boy, David, right? Because he can do anything, including he's a badass guitar player. So he goes over and he's a good looking kid too. That's important. He's no uggo. He's just a little bit short. So good looking guy with a good voice. And you don't have a record player, okay? Your record player is a man. He plays things for you there, and that's it. That's the noises you're going to hear in terms of music your whole life. So that's probably pretty valuable, I'm guessing.
It's not a bad Pokemon power.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're living in a dystopia, and you kidnap Eddie Van Halen, and he is now your player. Be like, play for me, Eddie Van Halen, or I will kill you. That's what I would do in my dystopia. Kidnap musical stars, because I know that entertainment will be in the future when things settle down.
You don't think being kidnapped would affect the artistic atmosphere?
Yes, but by then the quality of everyone else who has barely survived the apocalypse will really make them still look pretty good. Yeah, and even sometimes duress can work in their favor. 'Tis a new theory I'm testing in my mad dystopia. Can Eddie Van Halen produce even more brilliant works now that I have a stick near his anus?
My goodness, sticks and anuses this show.
Right, well, you know, I stick with visuals that I start with. I like to bring it all, you know, full circle here. I'm sorry I started with it. Had I started with something else, we would have gone there. I'm sorry I put that visual in your head. You're just going to have to deal with the fact that you have a vivid imagination. And curse whoever told you to pursue your imagination and dreams, Ryan.
Yeah, I just keep on telling myself, don't think about the pink elephant. But of course, that just makes you think about it, the pink elephant.
It's the only thing you can think about at that point, really. So David is the superstar, and as a result, he's given the cushiest job, which is armor bearer. That is, you know, like, that's the equivalent of a really cushy government job. That's what he gives them, a cushy government job. Armor bearer. Although, you know, honestly, there are some dangers associated with armor bearers, you know, i.e. battlefield conditions. But I think that at that time, everything is dangerous. So that's why it did sound like it was pretty cushy. Because of Saul's persistence to not kill all his enemies begin to gather in strength. And now the Philistines have amassed a bit of an army, and I guess they want retribution for the various conflicts that these two are inevitably engaged in. And they amass an army. This is a story actually people are really familiar with, the David and Goliath story. This is it, folks. We're about to cover David and Goliath. Isn't that exciting? It's happening in real time.
Yeah, it's one of those ones you always hear about because it's, you know, one of the few interesting ones that'll keep kids sitting on Sunday school.
Yeah, again, I have to wonder how they describe this one story, but we'll see. We'll see how it compares to what you remember if you aren't familiar with it. So they have this encampment, and obviously both sides are debating about whether or not to fight each other. And Goliath, who's a fairly large man of the city of Gath, like, you know, who knows how big he is, but he's obviously much larger than everybody else. He's a big motherfucker. And he offers up this challenge. He's like, why should we kill each other with our armies? Why don't you send out a champion? And if he wins, then we will be your slaves. And if I win, then you'll be our slaves. And then there doesn't have to be any fucking other bloodshed.
You know, I would seriously doubt that the army that loses would lay down their arms and willingly become slaves after that. I just have a theory that maybe that wouldn't happen in the afterwards. You know, you'd have to figure out some way to, I don't know, try and make sure that would actually happen.
It doesn't seem like a fair thing. That's okay. And
just not practical. Just not practical. Right. Maybe I don't know.
Maybe what they need is some kind of, this is what's going to happen in the future, where wars are going to be fought with mega boxing champions that are in floating domes that fight for world domination.
Well, let me tell you what, Syria would really love something like that. A system like that would be totally cool.
A lot of Eastern European countries would really actually love that method of solving problems.
That's very true.
Punchy, punchy. Yes, Goliath is giving out this challenge, but obviously he's a huge man. With, you know, there's obviously this distorted view of him. They're like, he weighs this, you know, his armor was 300 pounds and his spear was 100 pounds. He was a giant of a man. So obviously he's big and everybody's scared shitless. And, nobody knows what to do because is everybody going to attack and you're just going to look like pussies and everyone's going to be demoralized? Like, clearly it's just kind of a weird confrontation part. But this Mortal Kombat thing could turn the tide, I guess, is the way that everybody feels. And meanwhile, David he's back home. He wants in this battle. So he just takes a bunch of food and he pretends that he's there to just deliver the food, but really he's there secretly to find out what the fuck is happening. And Saul's been giving, you know, everybody's like, if anyone comes forward and fights this dude, I'll give him my property, which means my daughter, and a whole bunch of gold and shit like that. And he's, you know, this is what David's going around asking. Like, hey, what's the dealio? One of his brothers sees this, and his brother's actually a warrior. And he's like, what the fuck are you doing here, dude? It's like asking all these questions. Get out of here. And he's like, hey, man. It was like, what's with the overreaction? I'm just curious. I just want to find out what's happening. And remember, he's got that whole power Grayskull confidence that we, again, find so terrifying. Finds out that there's this Goliath guy, so he goes to Saul and he's like, all right, I want to fight him and I think I can win. So if, you know, obviously Saul's like, what are you talking about? You're a tiny dude. You've never been in a war ever, and you're dressed in pretty much a cloth with a belt on it. That's what he looks like. Well, maybe he's got a bandana or something like that to just look badass. But otherwise, he's not looking exactly like the kind of warrior that should take on what is probably a walking tank of a person. It's like, okay, well, I like your theory going out there. But apparently, David lays out this very compelling argument. He says, well, first of all, you got to know that shepherding is a lot more dangerous than you might imagine. There's lions and things, which I've killed with my slingshot, Dennis the Menace style.
Oh, I'm sure back in the day, like, those things were, you know, very different and very functional just towards, you know, murdering, killing and murdering things.
All right, fine. So you take out a lion with one, and everybody exaggerates. Like, you took out something that was moving in the distance and you claim it's a lion. Come on now. I mean, you got real proof that maybe the lion just didn't slip and it kind of died by accident or something?
It's really good bragging. When you think about that, if you can pull that off and tell people, like, imagine the chicks. He fucking killed a lion with his sling.
It's true. It's true. But, you know, you got to imagine that the lion's not going to attack you first, so you're not his primary target.
What
so
are you talking about? I'm sure back in the day, man, people were terrified because, yes, they were definitely part of the food chain. In areas like that, I'm sure lions...
Yeah, but
lions...
if you got a choice between a sheep and a human, you're going to take a sheep on.
Yeah, sure.
You're going to eat the one that strays on the outside. So if you kill that lion, it just means you're probably a good shot. All right, that's fine. You're a good shot. The guy's probably wearing a helmet and stuff, which is why the next part is so confusing, right? Because, all right, Saul gives him permission. He's like, here you go. Take this armor that I got going on. You know, his magical armor that they have. But David takes one look at it, and he's like, nah, I don't want it. I'm just going to go out in my regular thing. This is what I'm going to do.
I like fighting in a thong.
I like a little bit of breeze, you know, when I fight. My balls get a little wet.
I like my mobility. My mobility is important. Just grease me up.
That's
now.
Right.
Grease
okay.
me up.
So he's a highly mobile. He makes sure that he greases up his nipples so he doesn't have any rubbing on his sheet. That's what he does. And so he comes out to face Goliath. He's probably just laying there, just chilling out. I mean, he spent 3 days baiting these dudes, and no one wants to budge. So by then, he's probably like, we're just going to keep demoralizing them for days. So he sees David walk up to him, and at first he's a little bit incredulous. He's sort of like, am I a dog or something? Are we here to play fetch, little boy? Why don't you get the fuck out of here before I tear you up into about a billion pieces? David's like, well, I may not look like a warrior, I may not look like shit, but I bring with me the wrath of God. And he's given me the power to kill the crap out of you. And once you're dead, I'm going to cut off your head, and I'm going to feed the rest of you and all of your friends that we're going to kill right after to the birds. And I'm just going to display your head all around, and it's going to be a trophy. That's what I'm about to do. That's his hello.
It's not bad, smack.
Yeah, yeah. I'll give him credit for some smack. So Goliath gets up, and as he's about to beat him into, you know, a tiny red smear, David reaches into his sack, and takes out a rock, and slings it, and he hits Goliath right on the temple, because I guess Goliath decides that he doesn't need to wear a helmet, or he has some kind of magically shattered helmet or something like that. He basically hits him in some miracle spot, and Goliath just fucking dies instantly. He just collapses, and it's over. I think he just hit him in his pituitary gland that was probably have, you know, some kind of mutation or something. Some kind of weird tumor. It's not a tumor! And as soon as sort of Goliath dies, everybody's a bit in shock. And all of a sudden, the Jews have this any given Sunday style, like, crazy, ecstatic drunkenness, and they go over and they start massacring all the Philistines, who are just freaked out at this point. They just do not know what's happening. They're like, this tiny little chihuahua just took out this Great Dane. So it's a big freak out. And everybody gets slaughtered. And what they do is they leave out all the bodies lying out in the sun. So everybody gets the clear message that the boys are back in town. The boys are back in town. That's how you had to do it, eh? Be all badass and shit?
Oh, slaughter. You're so regular in the Bible.
It's like clockwork. So now that David's killed Goliath, he's like the Justin Bieber of the land now. He's a superstar. And the people begin to love him. I guess he's a hero now or something. And this is when Saul decides to bring him into the family. And he meets, for the first time, Jonathan, who's going to have the most inappropriate friendship in the history of mankind. Every gay man who's repressed and still loves the Bible probably obsessively reads the relationship between David and Jonathan. There is no way to not make it gay, even when you're reading it literally. It's very difficult. With the kissing and embracing and tearing up near each other and crying all the time, you're just like, guys, man, what's happening?
Get a room.
Get a fucking room. And the way that Jonathan talks about it, too, it's clear that Jonathan is the one that loves him a little bit more, and it's sometimes a bit scary. I'll never love a woman the way I love this guy. And you're just like, well, that's cool, I guess. It's pretty Greek of you. But I think that a lot of people are afraid of that relationship. But still, you know, if you meet a Bible thumper and he's constantly talking to you about the relationship between David and Jonathan, the alarm bell should be going off in your fucking brain here. All right. This boy's probably repressed. Everybody's really happy for a little while. It's almost like the fucking Brady Bunch. Hey, we've been excellent at slaughtering our enemies, and the future's bright, and the empire is, well, our empire, whatever they think is an empire, is slowly building. The future's looking good, except for the fact that, of course, Saul had been disowned by the priests. But, you know, they seem willy-nilly, and their standards of voting people into power seems pretty illegitimate. Who is the tallest? Bring out the ruler! Maybe that's why they call them rulers, huh? Because you have to measure how tall they were.
That was terrible.
Come on, that was good. I mean, it's in the Bible. It's the thing of it's where everything lies, right? All truth is in the Bible. That's why rulers are called rulers. I'm interpreting the Bible and being able to make historical facts. Isn't that great? Man, no wonder they do it. It's easy as shit.
Yeah, but you're using it for evil.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm the devil.
Terrible joke devil.
Yeah, I guess he's a joke devil.
Is this hell? These terrible jokes. Okay, let's keep going.
Okay, so now that they're one big fucking happy family, Saul begins to be a little bit worried that David is stealing all the thunder, and perhaps even suspecting that he may be the new guy to take over his place. So he gets to that stage where most kings get to, where they're starting to be a bit old and feeble, and now they're really paranoid about anyone who might take away their crown and their nepotism, right? They want their own offspring to succeed them. They're desperate for that to make sure, and they become very paranoid of anyone who may actually put that in jeopardy. We've seen this countless times in every stupid conflict where just the king monkey wants to make sure that his monkey offspring are the ones that rule. And typically these monkey offspring suck because the parents are so busy trying to have power that they don't properly raise them and they have monster children. Is that not like the cycle?
Yeah, and think about this. Those monster children run everything now.
Well, you're going to see that so countlessly. I actually think that Saul is the exception, because Jonathan seems like he's a good guy, right? But David's kids, I mean, as we're going to see in part three, they're shitty. They're shitty.
But shitty for God?
No, they're just all around crappy. They try to justify it as in, well, David sinned is why his kids were terrible. But I'm like, I'm pretty sure that your kids are just bad because you're a bad parent. Maybe that's your sin.
How terrible of a parent must you be for it to, like, make it into the Bible? Like, this is the story of the guy and his kids were shits. Rapists and motherfuckers. It's like, whoa.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel bad in part one for Eli. Remember when they said that his sons were just gigantic pieces of shit that God kills? And then when he's informed of the news, he falls over, and because he's a big fat tub of shit, and that's how they describe him, by the way, he breaks his neck and dies. And you're just like, well, that's where you are in the Bible, man. You're the guy who, you are almost on par with the guy who died trying to suck his own dick. Like, that's how embarrassing it is.
Which book of the Bible was that in?
There's no book of the Bible that's like that, but, you know, I'm just saying, I'm trying to think about the most embarrassing thing, death possible. Can you come up with a better one? I mean, David Carradine's death is pretty embarrassing.
Well, I always like how they always say, like, when a person dies shitting themselves, like, from dysentery or whatever like that, like, the rude way of saying it is that you just died shitting yourself. You shat yourself to death. I know that's a pretty common one, apparently, in the Middle East when they want to make fun of someone. Ah, you died of dysentery.
That is a pretty embarrassing one. I'll give you that. Dying of the shits. All right. But I don't think it beats mine. I have been actually thinking about this. What is the most embarrassing death in the world? If you guys have any ideas, please leave them in the comments. They can be as embarrassing as possible. I'm just trying to imagine, and I think I'm unimaginative. I can't come up with anything. That's my problem. I have no imagination. So perhaps some of you who have boring-ass commutes and have nothing but time on your hands to come up with imaginative, horrible ways that people could die in embarrassing fashion, you could let me know. And then I'll do nothing with that data, but enjoy it.
Lend him your brain cycles.
Could you please? I'm only requiring about 10 minutes of processing power. Lend me your thoughts. Your horrible, horrible thoughts. And maybe we'll find some gold there. But more likely, just it'll be an awful idea that I'll regret instantly. All right, let's go back to Saul feeling very paranoid. So I think he's torn at this point because he loves David, but he obviously fears David. And these types of relationships are terrifying. So what Saul decides to do first is like, well, maybe I can get rid of David by putting him in the front lines of war and making him do risky tasks, and that way, maybe he'll die. He thinks to himself, first what I'll need to do is I'll need to ally myself with David. I don't understand what his dealio is, but he's like, I'll need to offer David something that he has to fight for. So he's like, well, I'll offer him my daughter, Merib. He's like, why don't you marry her? And then you'll just have to do something for me, Godfather style. You know what I mean? One of these days, and that day may never come. So David's like, well,
please don't kill me. It's like, that will be the favor. I'm calling in this favor. Don't murder me.
Well, he can't let anybody know of his suspicion. That wouldn't be paranoia. That would be just an honest conversation about some of your fears, which would greatly eliminate, you know.
Could be awkward. Could be awkward, depending on how it goes. That's a conversation you want to be very careful about having. Just make sure that he's not able to stab you right there, too.
Yeah, be glad you live in our time. David manages to talk his way out by saying, well, you know, I'm just a nobody, so I can't marry the king's daughter. I can't marry a princess. I haven't done shit, you know, despite the fact that he's killed Goliath and all these other kinds of things. Again, I think that, I don't know if he's trying to be humble or if he realizes subtly that maybe there's some kind of suspicious shit going down. Who knows? That relationship cools off, and Merib, she gets married off to some other guy. And meanwhile, Michal falls for his good looks. And when Saul sees her, you know, giving him the fuck me eyes, he's like, all right, I have a second chance at this. So then he says, well, okay, I need to give David something that he can do, but that will still put him in danger. So he's like, well, I'll give you my youngest daughter if you bring back 100 foreskins of Philistine men. So David is like, fucking, that's it? 100? That's all you want? He's like, all right, cool. I'm going to get to marry the princess. So I guess he's not really aware of the danger that he's just about to embark. And he thinks to himself, well, I already killed a whole bunch of people. What's 200 Philistine foreskins?
Well, yeah, that's what I kind of wanted to know. Is like it was implied in all of this that you murdered the Philistines, and then the foreskins are trophies, right?
Yeah, they're like, it's like scalping someone. You don't scalp someone who's still alive.
So twisted.
We are disgusting creatures, despisable at times, are we not?
Well, and here's what I'm wondering, because it says foreskins, but you got to figure that they're not going to go in there with a scalpel and just like take that tiny little bit. They must be like going in there. Is this just code for cut their dicks off and bring me a bag of dicks?
Yeah, kind of, pretty much. Probably without, minus the balls or whatever, because that's probably where the big mess
lies. Well, look, that's where you're really, you'd have to get in there with a knife. And again, it just becomes difficult. I'm pretty sure you just like grab and just shuck it up right off.
Yeah. With a bronze, not particularly sharpened sword.
Yeah, then we're hoping that they're killing the Philistines. Then in that case, I'd be like, yes, kill them first, please. Be nice. Be civilized.
Well, there's a few times where they they use circumcision as a tool. Jacob's sons use this as a method to effectively disable the men that they slaughter. So sometimes you can use it to your advantage and be a big dick about it. David sets out, and it's no problemo, comes back with a bag of 200 dicks, so he doubles the Saul's number, and the two are wed, and it's like, all right, well, I guess David is part of the family, and now his plan to have him killed in battle does not go too good. He should have probably raised that number to like a million dicks or something. I don't know. What would have been a good number? 100 seems low. You're trying to kill a guy. Only 100? You know he's got a posse and everybody loves him. I mean, I would send him to Death Valley or something.
Saul's versed enough in Bible stuff to know that you really got to put those numbers up. I mean, all these armies are in the hundreds of thousands. You want to do something impressive, it should have at least been 1,000.
Yeah.
1,000 is reasonable.
And get this. Here's the other way that it backfires. Sending him out to battle all the time, trying to sort of like kind of get rid of him that way, means that he goes over and he's slaughtering everybody left and right, and people start chanting this new song, being like, oh, well, Saul's killed thousands, but David's killed tens of thousands, and that's how we measure heroes, how many people you've slaughtered. He's a level 20, and you're just like level 10.
So he's got the best soccer chant now.
He's got the better soccer chant. In fact, apparently the soccer chant is well known throughout the land. So maybe it rhymes in some language that I'm not familiar with, or it's really just, I don't know, it's got a good jingle.
You sing it to the rhyme of some popular song. It's a lot of fun. You get a couple beers into and you just can't stop.
And I got to ask, I mean, okay, the song is out there and it becomes really popular. But, you know, David's a poet and he's a musician. I think he probably composed it himself. This is bullshit. So I'd write my own song. Jacob is awesome. Jacob is awesome. Yep, there we go. It's pretty much the equivalent. I mean, it's not a great song. It's like, Saul has killed 1,000, David 10,000. Woo! 10,000.
I'm sure there's some kind of neat language wordplay you can do there with the 1,000, 10,000. You know, there's I could definitely make some kind of really good political sing-song thing. I could be like a... What is this? What year is this? Where are we in history?
This is supposed to happen in around the 11th century BCE, although that's probably not what it is at all.
Yeah, so 11th century BCE, political correspondent, I could do that.
What? All right.
I could...
that's a... It would be fun. I mean, I did see someone do something similar where they're like, what if the Bible was in today? Although it was a bit milquetoast. There's a song about how many people a guy has massacred. All right? And we can't do it justice. But it's like I said, it's Bieber-esque. It's everywhere. Everybody keeps humming it. Saul has his thousands. David his tens of thousands. Yeah! Massacre. You know, Saul hears that song, and I think that pretty much... snap something in his brain or something like that, because they're in the throne room, and David's singing a song. Not that one, by the way. That's a smart move. Don't sing that song to the king. He's just, you know, doing his whole sing-songy thing, and the king just gets fucking annoyed. So he grabs a spear, and he fucking chucks it right at David, and narrowly missing him, David just jumps out of the way and kind of runs home. And this happens again later. When, you know, probably after a few apologies, I imagine it's like, oh, sorry about that. You know, I had a bit of a temper, and I'm assuming he probably drinks quite a bit. He seems like a drunk.
I figure back in the day, you can't hold it against your king if he, like, tries to kill you, like, once. Because it's just, you know, they're on a different level. They probably do that all the time. It's kind of like Longshanks in Braveheart where he throws his fucking son out the window. Murder like that, it's just... it happens. And with the king, it's like the king summoning you back. You're hoping he's going to apologize to you and not murder you.
I like how you're using as a historical evidence a movie. It's factually
not. Yeah, I know it didn't happen. Yeah.
But
yeah,
no,
yeah.
All I'm saying is I do love that we did.
Everything is fictional here. You know, on the Good Atheist Show, we talk about nothing but things that didn't happen.
It's very true. That's a good point. I was going to chastise you for bringing it up a notch. Sarcastically. But, you know, you called it right. This is a show of utter fiction. So I can't be mad at you for bringing other visually striking fiction into the mix.
Okay, so tell me what doesn't happen next.
All right, well, here's what doesn't happen next. David gets pretty scared, so he goes to see his best friend, Jonathan, and he's like, hey, man, your dad just tried to kill me twice, so maybe we should go and talk to him. So everybody comes together, and again, the king's probably doing the whole kingly apology. I'm sorry that you were in the way of that spear. I'm sorry that spear almost killed you. I think that's what that's how I'd apologize as a king.
Well, how many people in America have to, you know, go to somebody, I apologize for shooting my gun at you. I was really drunk or something, or really high, and I just, you know, I pulled it out, pointed at you, and pulled the trigger. I apologize. I'm glad that I didn't kill you.
So life goes back to normal, and David keeps doing his whole sing-song dance thingamajiggy, but he's unfortunately continues to grow in popularity, much like Bieber. And much like Bieber, an assassination attempt is made once again by the king, who I think his motives are clear now. I think by the third time, apologies are just not going to work anymore. So David runs home to and locks himself in there. And Saul sends two of his guards, and he's like, all right, wait outside his door. And when he comes out, I don't know, to piss or something like that, whatever their fucking morning ritual is, he's like, when he comes out for his morning ritual, I want you to kill him and keep it on the low. I do not want anyone to know. So this is not like a general alert here thing. It's just sort of like, hey, trusted guards, take this fucking guy out. And, you know, they don't care that he's super Mr. Popular. They're just like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And he's a dead man. So they're waiting by the door. His wife, Mikal, says, if you stay here, you're fucking dead meat. So she helps him slip out the back. And then she takes an idol that's around the house, because I guess they still have idols. I thought they were supposed to smash these things. But whatever. There's an idol in the house. She puts it in the bed, and she puts a wig on it, a goat's hair wig, Ferris Bueller style, and that's the deception. So in the morning, when the soldiers come, and they're like, all right, where the fuck is he? Oh, he's sick. So the soldiers go back to King Saul, and they're like, oh, he's sick. We couldn't bring him out to kill him. Saul, very impressed by that, I imagine, being like, why don't you morons go grab him, and I'll kill him myself. Like, seriously, what? It's kind of like the American justice system, where they won't kill someone who's on death row if he's sick. It's like, what? Are you all retarded? We can't kill him. He has a cold. You're killing a person. Is that really your big concern here? So that's a guard fail. I'm surprised he didn't just kill. I would, you know, as a ruthless king, I would be like, kill these morons. I need two other guards I can trust with a job, as opposed to coming back and be like, oh, he's sick. We couldn't kill him. Fucking idiots. So they go back, and they uncover this pathetic ruse. And Saul's like, he goes over to his daughter and he's like, what the hell? Why did you deceive me? Why did you help him escape? And she does the honorable thing and she says, well, he threatened to kill me if I didn't help him. And that super bullshit answer gets her scot-free. I'm like, how gullible is this idiot? Your daughter tells you, well, he was going to kill me. Oh, what, when he was away and you carried on the deception for like a few hours after he was away? Yeah, I don't believe you. That'd be my thing. I think you're a fucking liar. I'm not Sherlock Holmes here. I think a little bit of logic, but I guess Saul is blind by paranoia or something like that. I don't know what.
Just another instance of women lying in the Bible. Never trust the women.
All right. So David heads to Ramah, which is where Samuel and I guess his religious posse that he set up are living. So you got the temple, and then you got, I guess, probably just a bunch of tents with these weirdos that just hang around, pretty much freeloading from people. They say they're doing God's work, but, you know, they're just eating people's sacrifices or even just taking their money. It's a big waste, like all religion. But they've got a little encampment, and everybody looks probably the same and has the same haircut and shit like that. So when David arrives, Samuel tells him, just hide in this encampment. And, you know, you're just going to blend in. So some of Saul's men arrive at the temple to come and take him away. But while they're there, all of a sudden they start going all crazy, freaky, epileptic, tearing at their clothes until they're fucking naked and writhing on the ground and speaking in tongues like they do in the South. They were prophesizing. Yeah, it kind of just looked like they were going apeshit. They call that prophesizing in the Bible. I think it had real powers other than just a person's brain not working right. once they find out, they send another troop of soldiers, and then they also have the same fucking freak out event. And then they send another bunch of soldiers, and then they also have it. So finally, Saul's like, all right, this is getting fucking ridiculous. I'm going to go there myself. And then on the way, he packs up his donkey or whatever other is the poshest mode of transportation at the time, the equivalent of a Cadillac. And on his way there, he himself has a fit, tears his clothes off, and he's like writhing in the dirt for like a whole day and a whole night. And then apparently there's like this whole saying that came out. What, is Saul a prophet too? Like another little bad mouth thing. It's kind of like a where's the beef level of catchphrase, which, you know, the people who wrote these specific books, the political agenda of the priest class, the Deuteronomist, yeah, it's pretty clear they didn't like Saul. Even in the Bible, they're talking shit. Be like, and that's why everyone said that, hey, Saul, you're a dickbag. Yeah, and that's where that comes from. Like, is that where that comes from? I think it comes from you saying that.
Is it another chant? Popular chant?
It's a popular chant, yeah. It's a smear campaign, you can tell. Just when you're reading it, you're like, well, he seemed to have had a good son. Because Jonathan seems like he's not fucked up. That's the only thing I can say about him. Because everything else, I'm like, smear campaign here.
Yeah, well, it's like, I'm sure that the Saul administration isn't responsible for all of Israel's problems. It's like
that. Blame the previous administration, and then you whitewash the fact that it was, you know, the same players all along. Politics never changes, I guess. So David sneaks back into town after things have cooled down a little bit, and he confronts Jonathan, and he's like, hey, dude, what is up with your dad who's trying to fucking kill me? And Jonathan's like, what are you talking about, man? He doesn't do anything without first talking to me, Mr. I'm a gullible idiot. It's like, oh, your dad, the king, tells you everything, huh? Yeah, he sent four regiments of soldiers to go kill a person, and you were not aware of this. I got news for you. You need to re-examine your relationship with your fucking father. Because, wow, talk about fucking gullibility city, man. Anyways, so he's all like, I don't really believe you. No way. My dad swore when we were there doing that whole buddy-buddy thing, my dad swore that he would not kill you. Oh, yeah, the word of a king right there. Yeah, it means fucking shit. That's what my reaction would be. And so David's like, look, here's what you're going to do. Here's our plan. You're going to find out if you're right, but I'm not going to be around because that would obviously be too dangerous. And there's this new moon festival that's just happening, and I guess that's their whole, you know, hey, anything to celebrate, right? Hey, it's the new moon. Let's get shit-faced. So it's a whole weekend thing. It's a big deal. It's like their Thanksgiving, I guess. So he's like, the king is going to expect me to be there, but I'm not going to be there. Now, if he asks where I am, you tell him that you asked for permission to go over and kill some animals for your deity with his family in Bethlehem. And, you know, under normal circumstances, a person would just accept that and be like, okay, he went to go be with his family on a Passover or whatever the fuck it is. And then be like, that's a reasonable request. But if he gets super pissed off, then you'll know that he's trying to kill me because it's a total overreaction. Now, I don't know about the logic of this, but all right, we're just going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he's right. I don't understand the subtle politics of regicidal maniacs, but Jonathan agrees to it. They make this cool spy-like system of communication. He's like, all right, so in case that you are correct, the following day, because it's going to obviously take a few days for him to sleuth around and find out if that's really true, it's like, I'm going to come out with my bow and arrow, and I'm going to be shooting at some stones. And I'm going to send my little servant boy to go and collect the arrows. And I'm going to give him a code word. And based on what I tell him there, you're going to know whether or not you're in danger or if everything's cool. They hug and they're like, all right, I'll see you in a few days. I'm going to hide out in the field or something or whatever. So at the dinner table, the first day, the king doesn't say shit. You know, figures, ah, well, maybe he was unclean, meaning that he had sex with a woman recently, and he can't be around us while we're eating.
Well, I guess in a land where showers are kind of difficult to have, if you've just lain with a woman, like, oh, I can't come to dinner, I reek of sex. Dirty, hot, fucking desert sex, too.
Unidentified juices. Probably a real stink.
Yeah, and you got to figure, like, if you've ever come back from 3 days of camping without taking care of business, you know how it's already pretty all gummed up and pugnant. So I can't even imagine 11th century BC.
Do you know what kind of, here's my adjective for that. It's smeggy. Yeah, there you go. There's that other imagery.
The cheese we make.
It's man cheese. Yeah, when you're in the process of making man cheese, don't come to the dinner table. But on the second day, King's like, all right, where's David? He's not at his normal seat. So Jonathan says, well, you know, tells him the lie. And then all of a sudden the king goes fucking ape shit. And he's like, you son of a whore, you little bastard. You don't think I can see what you're doing? How can you dishonor your whore mother by even trying to usurp your own birthright, man? This guy is going to take over the throne and you're going to be left with nothing. So Jonathan, who sees this gigantic overreaction over nothing, and again, I guess he's Mr. fucking gullible, and he's like, well, what has he done? I guess he's not cluing in as to why his father's paranoid. What has he done that merits him to be killed? Saul's logical answer is to grab a spear and to attempt to kill his own son. But he misses again, proving two things. One is that Saul is seriously a bad shot. I don't think he's hit anybody. And two, he's pretty fucking serious about this I want David dead business. Like, I think he wants him dead. So Mr. fucking Thick in the Head finally decides, all right, it's time to let David in on this business. I finally figured it out. I'm on the same page as everybody else. So he goes out with his little bow and arrow, and they do that whole communication trick that he lets him know that he's in great danger and he should lay low. So he sends his little Fletcher. I don't know if he's really a Fletcher, but whoever carried his caddy, I guess, whoever carries his arrows when he's practicing, because God knows he can't go get them. By the time he's alone, David comes out of his hiding place, and now you have that moment that's very, very gay. Every movie where they show this scene, you cannot make this scene not look gay. Because they're crying, they're kissing, they're hugging. I mean, I'm saying there's nothing wrong with that, but that's their relationship right there. And that's why every single gay man who tells you, if this is religious, every gay religious man who tells you that he loves the David and Jonathan relationship, yeah. You found out a clue, man. You found out a clue. The kissing, the hugging, and their special romance that no woman can touch with a 10-foot pole.
I don't know. Maybe it's just okay there to do that. It's kind of like in China where all men hold, while boys hold hands and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, it's that one part where you realize that sometimes male friendship have things that resemble marriage a little bit too closely.
Yeah, well, look, maybe back then, you know, sucking another guy's dick was just a good friend and nothing wrong with that. And it was just kind of like a tradition. Now, they didn't do it everywhere, but like in that region, yeah, it's just...
It's what good friends do. They suck a dick.
It is known.
Well, in those lonely desert nights, definitely. I need release. You're my friend. We are travelers together.
Besides, it's pretty cool if in the end David overthrows Saul and it's his gay son that totally helps him do it. I mean, that's practically worthy of its own HBO miniseries.
No, that's not how it's going to end, though.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, we're almost done part two, though. Because now, after they finish hugging each other and having that sort of like a very emotional scene where they, I guess they realize we're probably never going to see each other again, and you know, you're dead meat, I guess. The king wants you dead, and I can't abandon my dad, and I swore a loving bromance friendship with you forever and ever, bestie, but I got to pick my dad on this one, and off you go, and good luck with everything. Of course, he probably feels terrible, but you know, he's like the typical person who's like, well, I'm going to stick with my dad on this one. That's not surprising, though. His dad is the king.
Yeah, you can't betray your dad.
Not when he's the fucking king. What are you going to do? Oh, well, from that point on, me and my best friend lived in a cave until we died. Gee, that sounds like fun. What a life.
Friendships sustained us.
It sustained us for 3 weeks until we turned on each other and I killed him. Well, that's a beautiful end to a friendship, I think. So now that David is a marked man, he heads over to the city of Nob, and there he sees one of the main priests called Ahimelech, who's shocked to see him because I guess a well-known warrior who arrives alone and who skulks around, I'd probably be scared shitless too. Oh, this man has murdered tens of thousands of people. That said so in the song. And he's come here and I'm alone. So he's a little bit shaken up and he's like, what are you doing here all alone? What the fuck is going on? So David says, well, I'm here on kingly business, on a secret mission or something. And he's like, well, do you have any food? I'm here for some food too. And they're like, well, we don't really have food, although we do have the holy bread that's normally reserved for the deity. But so long as no one's fucked anyone recently, you can have this bread. Because I guess you can't be smeggy when you eat bread or holy bread or something. God cannot stand the smell. He hates it. No sex on my altar, you bastards. That must be the ultimate sacrilege, really. Sex on the altar. Because he clearly hates it. Or is it masturbation? What would be worse, sex or masturbation on the altar?
Masturbation, because it's lamer. I mean, at least if you can have sex on there, it's... masturbating is definitely creepier and more evil.
Yeah, I think it's the sex one, especially because you could be like, sex with two guys having sex on the altar. There you go.
Why not four?
I don't think it really compounds.
I don't know. I think a full-on gangbang, just a mess of everything is pretty... That gets it up there because, I think overall it does the trick.
I wonder if we've put an idea in somebody's head right now.
The reverse of Pussy Riot, some kind of penis riot.
Well, I guess we'll find out. Hopefully we won't get in trouble. Well, we put the idea of these young men's heads of having gay sex on altars. That was us. And then we become public enemy number one for scary Russian people. That's what's going to happen. I don't want that. Please don't kill me, Russian mafia. So he gets the loaf, and he's lucky enough that the loaf is fresh, because usually I'm assuming that the bread that they give to God is probably that one that you've just been like, I was going to throw this anyway, so here you go, God. More of human beings trying to trick gods. Do a little switcheroo when it comes to their sacrifices. It's like, oh, that wasn't a turkey that I burned. It was just a paper turkey. Oh, whoops. Whoops. You saw that one. Hey, don't smite me.
He's always smiting everybody.
Well, smiting is inevitable. That's nature for you. It's smiteful. That's what you live on. You live on a smiteful, cooling ball of rock spaceship orbiting a massive nuclear reactor. Sometimes things don't go as planned. On this mad spaceship. So he's got the food, and then he asks, oh, I was in such a hurry when the king sent me off that I didn't bring a weapon. Do you have a weapon here? And the priest is like, well, we only have one weapon. We have the giant sword that from Goliath, the guy that you killed. We kept his big, massive sword because, it's probably impractical considering everybody's size. And he's like, holy shit, you have that? All right. There is, like, no other better sword than that thing. It's like it must be, like, Zelda's sword or something like that. Does it have a name? In the Zelda, the sword?
Master Sword. It's the Master Sword.
Master Sword, thank you. All right, so he basically, he gets the Master Sword, and they just hand it over. In the corner, though, while all of this is happening, and David's there lying his ass off, there's this guy, he's an Edomite, so he's basically a foreigner, who's in the corner, he's watching what's happening. If this was a movie, I'd zoom in on his eyes, and it'd be like one of those, da-da-da, kind of thing. Yeah, and that's where we end part two, because that guy saw what happened. It was a witch.
What a cliffhanger.
Cliffhanger? Yeah, do you like that ending, though?
Well, is it going to affect things, or just one of those things that gets thrown in the Bible and just never comes up again? Oh, structure.
It's going to have some pretty fucking profound consequences to the people that he saw and what happened. And, yeah, I don't want to give away the part two, but the beginning of it is a lot of people to die. Because of that. So it'll have consequences. Yay, deaths. So that's why I went, dun, dun, dun. It's a real cliffhanger.
Yeah, not bad. I liked it.
That concludes part two of Bible Stories. All right, we're going to leave it at that. And I'm not quite sure when we're going to do part three, probably in a couple of weeks, maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And in the meantime, I've got a number of really awesome interviews lined up. I want to remind everyone that there's only a few days left to go on the site and vote on what you think the top five best interviews are for the upcoming Essentials DVD. So please go to the site and vote so that your vote counts. There's still lots of guys that are really close. It was difficult for me to pick, but I thought, hey, here's 8 or 9 really good interviews. Please pick out of those ones which you think are the most representative. So you can have a voice for the Essentials. Please have one, but there is a limited time, and I know that some of you it takes a few days before you listen to the podcast. So go right now. Don't you wait. Well, unless you're driving, don't do that. Don't text or browse sites and drive. Please, I beg of you. Unless, of course, you're on PayPal buying a membership. I might condone that. Yeah, buy my product. Become a hardcore member. That's how we sort of keep doing this thing. The people that are hardcores, $5 a month, you keep us going. So we need your continued support.
You will note that there are no shitty Audible ads at the beginning of our show. You know, this is going to come to bite me in the ass when you actually do want Audible to do ads. But that does not happen right now. No advertisements. Not a hell of a lot of people clamoring to roll money into the atheism scene.
Yeah, it's a little...
You know, but don't worry about it, because it's not like the other side has a lot of money flowing into their coffers.
Oh, no, absolutely,
you know what I mean?
Not, no.
So...
They don't have any financial advantages either. We're not fighting a losing battle.
The tide of ignorance isn't washing over us, but, you know, no big deal. Whatever works for you guys.
If you want to buy one extra Starbucks coffee and that's what you do, that's how you think you contribute to the betterment of mankind, then go for it.
Yeah, no guilt, though.
You'll get none from me. You'll get none from us, because there's no advertising on this show. Thanks for listening. With that, my name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Ryan Harkness.
Have a good Atheist Day, everybody.